Chapter 16 of Greenmantle. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Missy, Guangzhou, China. Greenmantle by John Buchan. Chapter 16. The Battered Caravanserai. 2 days later, in the evening, we came to Angora, the first stage in our journey. The passports had arrived next morning, as Frau von Einem had promised, and with them a plan of our journey. Moore, one of the companions, who spoke a little English, was detailed to accompany us, a wise precaution, for no one of us had a word of Turkish. These were the sum of our instructions. I heard nothing more of Sandy, or Greenmantle, or the lady. We were meant to travel in our own party. We had the railway to Angora, a very comfortable German Schlafwagen tacked to the end of a troop train. There wasn't much to be seen of the country, for after we left the Bosphorus we ran into scuds of snow, and except that we seemed to be climbing onto a big plateau, I had no notion of the landscape. It was a marvel that we made such good time, for that line was congested beyond anything I have ever seen. The place was crawling with the Gallipoli troops, and every siding was packed with supply trucks. When we stopped, which we did on average about once an hour, you could see vast camps on both sides of the line, and often we struck regiments on the march along the railway track. They looked a fine, hardy lot of ruffians, but many were deplorably ragged, and I didn't think much of their boots. I wondered how they would do the 500 miles of road to Erzurum. Blenkiron played patience, and Peter and I took a hand at piquet, but mostly we smoked and yarned. Getting away from that infernal city had cheered us wonderfully. Now we were out on the open road, moving to the sound of the guns. At the worst, we should not perish like rats in a sewer. We would be all together, too, and that was a comfort. I think we felt the relief which a man who has been on a lonely outpost feels when he is brought back to his battalion. Besides, the thing had gone clean beyond our power to direct. It was no good planning and scheming, for none of us had a notion what the next step might be. We were fatalists now, believing in kismet, and that is a comfortable faith. All but Blenkiron. The coming of Hilda von Einem into the business had put a very ugly complexion on it for him. It was curious to see how she affected the different members of our gang. Peter did not care a rush. Man, woman, and hippogriff were the same to him. He met it all as calmly as if he were making plans to round up an old lion in a patch of bush, taking the facts as they came and working at them as if they were a sum of arithmetic. Sandy and I were impressed. It's no good denying it. Horribly impressed. But we were too interested to be scared. And we weren't a bit fascinated. We hated her too much for that. But she fairly struck Blenkiron dumb. He said himself it was just like a rattlesnake and a bird. I made him talk about her, for if he sat and brooded he would get worse. It was a strange thing that this man, the most imperturbable and I think about the most courageous I have ever met, should be paralyzed by a slim woman. There was no doubt about it. The thought of her made the future to him as black as a thundercloud. It took the power out of his joints, and if she was going to be much around, it looked as if Blenkiron might be counted out. I suggested that he was in love with her, but this he vehemently denied. "No, sir. I haven't got no sort of affection for the lady. My trouble is that she puts me out of countenance, and I can't fit her in as an antagonist. I guess we Americans haven't got the right poise for dealing with that kind of female. We've exalted our women folk into little tin gods, and at the same time left them out of the real business of life. Consequently, when we strike one playing the biggest kind of man's game, we can't place her. We aren't used to regarding them as anything except angels and children. I wish I had had you boys' upbringing." Angora was like my notion of some place such as Amiens in the retreat from Mons. It was one mass of troops and transport, the neck of the bottle, for more arrived every hour, and the only outlet was the single eastern road. The town was pandemonium, into which distracted German officers were trying to introduce some order. They didn't worry much about us, for the heart of Anatolia wasn't a likely hunting ground for suspicious characters. We took our passport to the commandant, who visa'd them readily, and told us he'd do his best to get us transport. We spent the night in a sort of hotel, where all four crowded into one little bedroom, and next morning I had my work cut out getting a motor car. It took 4 hours and the use of every great name in the Turkish Empire to raise a dingy sort of Studebaker, and another 2 to get the petrol and spare tires. As for a chauffeur, love or money couldn't find him, and I was compelled to drive the thing myself. We left just after midday, and swung out into bare, bleak downs patched with scrubby woodlands. There was no snow here, but a wind was blowing from the east, which searched the marrow. Presently we climbed up into hills, and the road, though not badly engineered to begin with, grew as rough as the channel of a stream. No wonder, for the traffic was like what one saw on that awful stretch between Kassel and Ypres, and there were no gangs of Belgian roadmakers to mend it up. We found troops by the thousands, striding along with their impassive Turkish faces, ox convoys, mule convoys, wagons drawn by sturdy little Anatolian horses, and, coming in the contrary direction, many shabby Red Crescent cars and wagons of the wounded. We had to crawl for hours on end, till we got past a block. Just before the darkening, we seemed to outstrip the first press, and had a clear run for about 10 miles over a low pass in the hills. I began to get anxious about the car, for it was a poor one at the best, and the road was guaranteed sooner or later to knock even a Rolls-Royce into scrap iron. All the same, it was glorious to be out in the open again. Peter's face wore a new look, and he sniffed the bitter air like a stag. There floated up from little wayside camps the odor of wood smoke and dung fires. That, and the curious acrid winter smell of great wind-blown spaces, will always come to my memory as I think of that day. Every hour brought me peace of mind and resolution. I felt as I had felt when the battalion first marched from Ayr towards the firing line, a kind of keying up and wild expectation. I'm not used to cities, and lounging about Constantinople had slackened my fiber. Now, as the sharp wind buffeted us, I felt braced to any kind of risk. We were on the great road to the east and the border hills, and soon we should stand upon the farthest battlefront of the war. This was no commonplace intelligence job, that was all over, and we were going into the firing zone, going to take part in what might be the downfall of our enemies. I didn't reflect that we were among those enemies, and would probably share their downfall if we were not shot earlier. The truth is, I had got out of the way of regarding the thing as a struggle between armies and nations. I hardly bothered to think where my sympathies lay. First and foremost, it was a contest between the four of us and a crazy woman, and this personal antagonism made the strife of armies only a dimly felt background. We slept that night like logs, on the floor of a dirty khan, and started next morning in a powder of snow. We were getting very high up now, and it was perishing cold. The companion, his name sounded like Hussein, had traveled the road before and told me what the places were, but they conveyed nothing to me. All morning we wriggled through a big lot of troops, a brigade at least, who swung along at a great pace with a fine free stride that I don't think I've ever seen bettered. I must say I took a fancy to the Turkish fighting man. I remembered the testimonial that our fellows gave him as a clean fighter, and I felt very bitter that Germany should have lugged him into this dirty business. They halted for a meal, and we stopped too, and lunched off some brown bread and dried figs and a flask of very sour wine. I had a few words with one of the officers who spoke a little German. He told me they were marching straight for Russia, since there had been a great Turkish victory in the Caucasus. "We have beaten the French and the British, and now it is Russia's turn," he said stolidly, as if repeating a lesson, but he added that he was mortally sick of war. In the afternoon, we cleared the column and had an open road for some hours. The land now had a tilt eastward, as if we were moving towards the valley of a great river. Soon we began to meet little parties of men coming from the east with a new look in their faces. The first lots of wounded had been the ordinary thing you see on every front, and there had been some pretense at organization. But these new lots were very weary and broken. They were often barefoot, and they seemed to have lost their transport and to be starving. You would find a group stretched by the roadside in the last stages of exhaustion. Then would come a party limping along, so tired that they never turned their heads to look at us. Almost all were wounded, some badly, and most were horribly thin. I wondered how my Turkish friend behind would explain the sight to his men, if he believed in a great victory. They had not the air of the backwash of a conquering army. Even Blankiron, who was no soldier, noticed it. "These boys look mighty bad," he observed. "We've got to hustle, Major, if we're going to get seats for the last act." That was my own feeling. The sight made me mad to get on faster, for I saw that big things were happening in the East. I had reckoned that 4 days would take us from Angora to Erzurum, but here it was the second nearly over, and we were not yet a third of the way. I pressed on recklessly, and that hurry was our undoing. I have said that the Studebaker was a rotten old car. Its steering gear was pretty dicky, and the bad surface and continual hairpin bends of the road didn't improve it. Soon we came into snow lying fairly deep, frozen hard and rutted by the big transport wagons. We bumped and bounced horribly and were shaken about like peas in a bladder. I began to be acutely anxious about the old bone shaker, the more as we seemed a long way short of the village I had proposed to spend the night in. Twilight was falling, and we were still in an unfeatured waste, crossing the shallow glen of a stream. There was a bridge at the bottom of a slope, a bridge of logs and earth which had apparently been freshly strengthened for heavy traffic. As we approached it at a good pace, the car ceased to answer to the wheel. I struggled desperately to keep it straight, but it swerved to the left, and we plunged over a bank into a marshy hollow. There was a sickening bump as we struck the lower ground, and the whole party were shot out into the frozen slush. I don't yet know how I escaped, for the car turned over, and by rights I should have had my back broken. But no one was hurt. Peter was laughing, and Blenkiron, after shaking the snow out of his hair, joined him. For myself, I was feverishly examining the machine. It was about as ugly as it could be, for the front axle was broken. Here was a piece of hopeless bad luck. We were stuck in the middle of Asia Minor with no means of conveyance, for to get a new axle there was as likely as to find snowballs on the Congo. It was all but dark, and there was no time to lose. I got out the petrol tins and spare tires and cached them among the rocks on the hillside. Then we collected our scanty baggage from the derelict Studebaker. Our only hope was Hussein. He had got to find us some lodging for the night, and next day we would have a try for horses or a lift in some passing wagon. I had no hope of another car. Every automobile in Anatolia would now be at a premium. It was so disgusting a mishap that we all took it quietly. It was too bad to be helped by hard swearing. Hussein and Peter set off on different sides of the road to prospect for a house, and Blenkiron and I sheltered under the nearest rock and smoked savagely. Hussein was the first to strike oil. He came back in 20 minutes with news of some kind of dwelling a couple of miles up the stream. He went off to collect Peter, and, humping our baggage, Blenkiron and I plodded up the waterside. Darkness had fallen thick by this time, and we took some bad tosses among the bogs. When Hussein and Peter overtook us, they found a better road, and presently we saw a light twinkle in the hollow ahead. It proved to be a wretched, tumble-down farm in a grove of poplars, a foul-smelling, muddy yard, a two-roomed hovel of a house, and a barn which was tolerably dry and which we selected for our sleeping place. The owner was a broken old fellow whose sons were all at the war, and he received us with the profound calm of one who expects nothing but unpleasantness from life. By this time we had recovered our tempers, and I was trying hard to put my new kismet philosophy into practice. I reckoned that if risks were foreordained, so were difficulties, and both must be taken as part of the day's work. With the remains of our provisions and some curdled milk, we satisfied our hunger and curled ourselves up among the pea straw of the barn. Blenkiron announced with a happy sigh that he had now been for 2 days quit of his dyspepsia. That night, I remember, I had a queer dream. I seemed to be in a wild place among mountains, and I was being hunted, though who was after me I couldn't tell. I remember sweating with fright, for I seemed to be quite alone, and the terror that was pursuing me was more than human. The place was horribly quiet and still, and there was deep snow lying everywhere, so that each step I took was heavy as lead. A very ordinary sort of nightmare, you will say? Yes, but there was one strange feature in this one. The night was pitch dark, but ahead of me, in the throat of the pass, there was one patch of light, and it showed a rum little hill with a rocky top, what we call in South Africa a castrel or saucepan. I had a notion that if I could get to that castrel, I should be safe, and I panted through the drifts towards it with the Avenger of Blood at my heels. I woke gasping to find the winter morning struggling through the cracked rafters, and to hear Blenkiron say cheerily that his duodenum had behaved all night like a gentleman. I lay still for a bit, trying to fix the dream, but it all dissolved into haze, except the picture of the little hill, which was quite clear in every detail. I told myself it was a reminiscence of the veldt, some spot down in the Wakkerstroom country, though for the life of me I couldn't place it. I pass over the next 3 days, for they were one uninterrupted series of heartbreaks. Hussein and Peter scoured the country for horses, Blenkiron sat in the barn and played patience, while I hunted the roadside near the bridge in the hope of picking up some kind of conveyance. My task was perfectly futile. The columns passed, casting wondering eyes on the wrecked car among the frozen rushes, but they could offer no help. My friend the Turkish officer promised to wire to Angora from some place or other for a fresh car, but remembering the state of affairs at Angora, I had no hope from that quarter. Cars passed, plenty of them, packed with staff officers, Turkish and German, but they were in far too big a hurry to even stop and speak. The only conclusion I reached from my roadside vigil was that things were getting very warm in the neighborhood of Erzurum. Everybody on that road seemed to be in mad haste, either to get there or to get away. Hussein was the best chance, for, as I have said, the companions had a very special and peculiar graft throughout the Turkish Empire. But the first day he came back empty-handed. All the horses had been commandeered for the war, he said, and though he was certain that some had been kept back and hidden away, he could not get on their track. The second day he returned with two, miserable screws, and deplorably short in the wind from a diet of beans. There was no decent corn or hay left in the countryside. The third day he picked up a nice little Arab stallion, in poor condition, it is true, but perfectly sound. For these beasts we paid good money, for Blenkiron was well supplied, and we had no time to spare for the interminable Oriental bargaining. Hussein said he had cleaned up the countryside, and I believed him. I dared not delay another day, even though it meant leaving him behind, but he had no notion of doing anything of the kind. He was a good runner, he said, and could keep up with such horses as ours forever. If this was the manner of our progress, I reckoned we would be weeks in getting to Erzurum. We started at dawn on the morning of the fourth day, after the old farmer had blessed us and sold us some stale rye bread. Blenkiron bestrode the Arab, being the heaviest, and Peter and I had the screws. My worst forebodings were soon realized, and Hussein, loping along at my side, had an easy job to keep up with us. We were about as slow as an ox wagon. The brutes were unshod, and with the rough roads I saw that their feet would very soon go to pieces. We jogged along like a tinker's caravan, about 5 miles to the hour, as feckless a party as ever disgraced a high road. The weather was now a drizzle, which increased my depression. Cars passed us and disappeared in the mist, going at 30 miles an hour to mock our slowness. None of us spoke, for the futility of the business clogged our spirits. I bit hard on my lip to curb my restlessness, and I think I would have sold my soul there and then for anything that could move fast. I don't know any sorer trial than to be mad for speed and to have to crawl at a snail's pace. I was getting ripe for any kind of desperate venture. About midday we descended on a wide plain full of the marks of rich cultivation. Villages became frequent, and the land was studded with olive groves and scarred with water furrows. From what I remembered of the map, I judged that we were coming to that champagne country near Sivas, which is the granary of Turkey and the home of the true Osmanli stock. Then at the corner of the road we came to the caravanserai. It was a dingy, battered place, with the pink plaster falling in patches from its walls. There was a courtyard abutting on the road, and a flat-topped house with a big hole in its side. It was a long way from any battleground, and I guessed that some explosion had wrought the damage. Behind it, a few hundred yards off, a detachment of cavalry were encamped beside a stream, with their horses tied up in long lines of pickets. And by the roadside, quite alone and deserted, stood a large, new motor car. In all the road before and behind there was no man to be seen except the troops by the stream. The owners, whoever they were, must be inside the caravanserai. I have said I was in the mood for some desperate deed, and lo and behold, Providence had given me the chance. I coveted that car as I have never coveted anything on earth. At the moment, all my plans had narrowed down to a feverish passion to get to the battlefield. We had to find Greenmantle at Erzurum, and once we were there, we should have Hilda von Einem's protection. It was a time of war, and a front of brass was the surest safety. But indeed, I could not figure out any plan worth speaking of. I saw only one thing, a fast car which might be ours. I said a word to the others, and we dismounted and tethered our horses at the near end of the courtyard. I heard the low hum of voices from the cavalrymen by the stream, but they were 300 yards off and could not see us. Peter was sent forward to scout in the courtyard. In the building itself there was but one window looking on the road, and that was in the upper floor. Meantime, I crawled along beside the wall to where the car stood and had a look at it. It was a splendid six-cylinder affair, brand new with the tires little worn. There were 7 tins of petrol stacked behind, as well as spare tires, and looking in, I saw map cases and field glasses strewn on the seats as if the owners had only got out for a minute to stretch their legs. Peter came back and reported that the courtyard was empty. There were men in the upper room, he said, more than one, for I heard their voices. They are moving about restlessly and may soon be coming out. I reckoned that there was no time to be lost, so I told the others to slip down the road 50 yards beyond the caravanserai and be ready to climb in as I passed. I had to start the infernal thing, and there might be shooting. I waited by the car till I saw them reach the right distance. I could hear voices from the second floor of the house and footsteps moving up and down. I was in a fever of anxiety, for any moment a man might come to the window. Then I flung myself on the starting handle and worked like a demon. The cold made the job difficult, and my heart was in my mouth, for the noise in that quiet place must have woke the dead. Then, by the mercy of heaven, the engine started, and I sprang to the driving seat, released the clutch, and opened the throttle. The great car shot forward, and I seemed to hear behind me shrill voices. A pistol bullet bored through my hat, and another buried itself in a cushion beside me. In a second, I was clear of the place, and the rest of the party were embarking. Blenkiron got on the step and rolled himself like a sack of coals into the tonneau. Peter nipped up beside me, and Hussein scrambled in from the back, over the folds of the hood. We had our baggage in our pockets and had nothing to carry. Bullets dropped round us, but did no harm. Then I heard a report at my ear, and out of a corner of my eye saw Peter lower his pistol. Presently we were out of range, and looking back I saw 3 men gesticulating in the middle of the road. "May the devil fly away with this pistol," said Peter ruefully. "I never could make good shooting with a little gun. Had I had my rifle—" "What did you shoot for?" I asked in amazement. "We've got the fellow's car, and we don't want to do them any harm." "It would have saved trouble had I had my rifle," said Peter quietly. "The little man you call Rasta was there, and he knew you. I heard him cry your name. He is an angry little man, and I observed that on this road there is a telegraph." End of chapter 16.